Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for another Behavioral Health Integration episode. Today, I have the pleasure of having Matthew Sizdek as a special guest on the show today. Matthew is a clinical psychologist and mental health and wellness coach. Matthew got his PhD in clinical psychology from Clark University, as well as a Master of Business Administration from the University of St. Thomas. Matthew specializes in men's mental health and different issues men go through in today's society. And in today's episode, we will be discussing a lot of those issues men go through as it comes to social media, community, stereotypes that men have to, again, endure to find their true selves and what it actually means to be a man. I, for one, am truly excited to have Matthew on the show. And without further ado, let's get started. Well, Matthew, thank you so much for being on the show today, man. I really appreciate it.
I'm thrilled to be here. I really look forward to the opportunity.
Yeah, and it's always good to get another Minnesota therapist on the show, too. So
it is a great network of mental health professionals here in Minnesota. A lot of great people, really passionate, and doing a lot of great things.
Oh, absolutely. And just right off the bat, so tell us a little bit about yourself. So you have your MBA, right?
Yeah, so I'm kind of a unique breed, I guess you could say. So I'm a clinical psychologist, but when I was working in large health systems, I realized that those systems really are businesses, and I didn't know anything about business. I'd been in school forever, but like didn't know anything about business, and I wanted to be a more effective leader and more effective manager, so then I went back and got an MBA.
So would you recommend an MBA for any therapist trying to own their own private practice, or would that be too much?
No, I wouldn't. Yeah, I'd say that would be too much. I mean, because people, when I talk to colleagues and say, yeah, I have an MBA, and they will then talk to me about their private practice, and they'll just assume that I know all this small business stuff. And I'm like, no, like I know about like business strategy and like balance sheets and HR stuff. I don't know like an S corp versus a whatever corp and how to like anything, you know, about like regular taxes. So I don't think an MBA is necessarily helpful from that perspective. Probably like some mini MBAs, which might help you as a clinician think from more of a business strategy standpoint so that you are making some good, I think, business decisions at really like a high level would probably be really quite useful. If somebody is a clinician and they want to get into leadership in like, you know, health systems or in like a larger group practice, like say if you're going to have, you know, 10, 15, 20, I think really once you get more like 15, 20, 30 therapists, then I really think it's really essential. And I've done some consulting for practices that are growing because clinicians are, you know, really great at you know, people skills and stuff, but they don't necessarily know some of the things around like policies and procedures and how to grow an organization. So it's likely helpful.
Absolutely. Now, growing up, what originally got you into the mental health field?
Yeah. So I mean, I think I was always that adolescent where like everybody would kind of come to me and tell me their problems. So that definitely, you know, moved me in that direction. But one of the more important experiences in my life was both being a YMCA camper and then moving on to the staff of a YMCA camp. And when YMCA, I think, is an amazing organization, do a lot of great youth development. I benefited from it and then tried to give back. And it was through the process of working with a lot of youth, especially a lot of adolescents and boys from the inner city, who were, really, I would start working with them, and they would be, like acting out. They would, come in with various labels, various, diagnoses. I think we're used to being, labeled as like a bad kid or being in trouble. And so, yeah, there would be some hitting and defiance and running away and those kinds of things that, yeah, would draw a lot of negative attention. But I found that as I got to know some of these boys and, whether it was like throwing the football around for a while or going in a canoe with them for a while, some of that hard outer shell would crumble.
Yeah.
And you would see like some of the maybe pain or emotional struggles that some of those sometimes really young boys, like 8, 9, 10 years old, would have this really hard outer shell, but they were just a little boy inside. And so seeing that contrast really was like, wow, this is powerful, and really unfortunate. And I want to help. Like, I've seen the benefit of connecting and helping them to talk through some of the issues and rather than acting out. And so I wanted to be able to do more of that. And then I read a book called Real Boys by William Pollack, which just blew my mind and talked a lot about what he called the boys code, but all the rules and restrictions that limited boys from expressing their feelings and being more emotional and relational and connected. And so the combination of those factors really drew me towards psychology, and then kind of just started down that path.
Yeah, it's a really powerful thing when you look from the outside and you see like an adult playing with a child, let's say shooting hoops, whatever, and you may look at them like, oh, well, they're just playing a game, whatever. They're not really doing anything therapeutic. But like you mentioned, you could break down so many barriers just in acts and activities like that.
Absolutely. Because it can be a lot. There could be some subtle social anxiety, not clinically, but like social anxiety that a lot of men and boys experience around other men. Some of it can be this sort of normative homophobia of just, I need to keep men at a distance and be on guard and make sure that I don't come off as gay. And so activity can be a way of breaking that down, because then they're not necessarily face-to-face, eye-to-eye, but sometimes they do open up. I think some guys have found that through alcohol, which has its limitations and consequences, of course. And I'm sure you can have seen a lot of that in your work. But I do agree, some activities, some sports, like going for walks and things like that, that can be a little more active, can engage a lot of men and some adolescent males.
So when you were working at the YMCA as a staff member, were you ever to a point where when you were talking to a kid and they were dealing with some major issues that you wanted to do more than you were capable of? Or were you more just content to doing what you're doing, just mirroring what they were saying and showing empathy and so forth?
I mean, the YMCA is an incredible organization. I feel like I did learn a lot of very basic helping skills just through their staff orientation. I remember like learning about basic phrases of like, just tell me more. And just trying to get people to open up some, and so those things like really did help. But absolutely, I felt like there's a lot going on here. This is very complex. My couple conversations with a kid over the course of a week at camp is just such a small a sliver in their summer, let alone in their life. And that I wanted to get more training and be able to be able to really make more lasting, help people make more lasting changes.
No, kind of what you did reminds me when I was at tech at a treatment center. You're doing the same thing. You're talking to the kids, you're interacting. Yeah, you're doing some other things like give meds and whatnot. But I think one thing we can both relate to is to remember the power of the work that we do. And for all the techs and all the workers out there, like you just said, you are still making a powerful impact in these kids' lives. And who knows, down the line, like 5, 10 years, they may still remember you, and they still may remember the impact in that moment that you had on them.
I completely agree that. Completely agree that. And those are sometimes also when you are in some of those roles, you also aren't quite as limited by the theories, the mental models, the role of being the mental health professional. And so you can be a little more human. And I think we have to somewhat unlearn some of our profession to connect with people again. And they're probably not quite as hindered by it. So.
Yeah. Yeah, not to get off track too much, but I've read in research where, now I'm sure this isn't always true, but like the more education you have and the more theories you know actually hinders your ability to be a therapist or to be not so, like, not really a good therapist, but like a quality therapist, because again, of the high amount of knowledge you have, maybe you lose like that one-on-one relationship building skills. I don't know.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if there's probably something to that. And I definitely have a lot of male clients I work with who love to intellectualize. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, like I'm a PhD, you know, I love to intellectualize too. So I can get pulled into that.
And no offense too, because I know beforehand you had a PhD, not saying that you're one of those, but.
Very well could be. I you know, definitely, you know, when working with a client very recently, I was like, you know, I think we intellectualized a lot today. And I think I got pulled into that. I think, like, you know, the issue that you've been trying to work on in your daily life, I think we did that in therapy today. We both overanalyzed this, got super cognitive, and we didn't really feel anything. I don't think you felt a lot. I don't think I felt a lot. And so, you know, I think it can definitely affect it. Some men in particular who might be pulled to less emotional, less relational approaches.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, going back now, so you got your undergrad where?
So my undergrad is at St. John's University up in Collegeville in Minnesota, an all-men's college. So I got the opportunity of, they had a men's leadership center there. So I got exposed to some work there around social norms and men's conformity to masculine norms and how it affected kind of some unhealthy behaviors that men could find themselves engaged in on campus. So that was a really cool environment that furthered my sort of interest in psychology and men and masculinity and men's mental health.
And then did you know then that, hey, I'm going to go to the PhD program and be a doctor?
Yeah, absolutely. And then I didn't get in. Oh. So I was like, this is my path. And then applied right out of undergrad. And like a lot of folks who apply on undergrad, they don't get in. So I didn't get in. And then I was discouraged. And then I got accepted to a master's program at Boston College. I applied to the PhD, got into the master's. There's a big researcher at Boston College in men's health. And so that's why I wanted to go there. So then it worked out still really well because I got to go there. And then I eventually became a research assistant for that professor. So I was able to still pursue some of my interest in the psychology of men and masculinity, even though I wasn't in a PhD program at that time.
So I know this is a tough question. Do you feel like you spend more time on research nowadays or one-on-one therapy work?
You know, I was really pulled towards research and teaching while I was in graduate school, but then I came out of graduate school during the Great Recession. And so all the faculty positions were nearly gone. I think I had one interview and I wasn't willing to go anywhere in the country. So I have very limited geography. So I've pretty much left behind the teaching and research and now really am more into clinical work, consultation, and coaching.
And then eventually you got more into the boys, adolescents, and men's mental health, right?
Yeah. So then I mean, really from undergrad, I was interested in that. Like, yeah. I mean, we're talking about like from right around the age, like 16, when I was at a Y camp, did I become interested in this area? So like I was intentional during undergrad, my master's program at Boston College. And then I chose my PhD program at Clark University in Worcester, Mass, to work with another leader in men's mental health there as well. So I chose my path really related to the psychology of men and masculinity and especially men's mental health. And so I was really fortunate. I was part, my faculty member at Clark University, Michael Addis, had a large NIMH federal grant. So we were able to do some cool research on men's help-seeking behaviors. And we developed a motivational interviewing intervention there to try to increase men's openness to seeking help for therapy and other kinds of things or for the problems that they were facing. So a really cool opportunity that I had to work with one of the leaders in the field and do some research in that area.
Absolutely. Now I want to move to a different avenue. And unfortunately, it's been a theme right now in the United States around the world, but these unfortunate mass shootings with men. And I know we were talking a little bit about this before about like masculinity and men. And there was this research that we were kind of going over about what are the reasons why these mass shootings are occurring, especially when men are actually doing it.
Yeah. You know, it's one of the completely in many parts of the media ignored aspects is that these are, you know, nearly exclusively men, adolescent males, and primarily white adolescent males perpetrating these mass shootings. Mm-hmm. And then some, you know, white men perpetrating these mass shootings. And so to ignore gender and race, I think, is to probably ignore much of what's actually going on here.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's always two arguments to the side. It's either it's gun control, right? Or it's just mental health. And people are, I'm sure, I mean, it's good that they're trying to find a solution, but the issue, there's so many things that could be happening here.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the even bigger issue around men and guns is men's death by suicide by guns. And so I think that even, when people like focus on mass shootings, like those are horrific and we need to focus on them. But even more people die, even more dead men die by self-inflicted gunshot wounds or other kinds of related violence. Yes, gun control is relevant for mass shootings, but also for suicide. And it's just really, really sad that, you know, men are four times more likely to die by suicide, largely due to the means that they choose, which is typically, you know, guns, and then to a lesser extent, suffocation and things like that, that are just much more lethal means.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about masculinity, do you feel like a lot of this is just done by obviously the men feeling depressed, insecure, but again, feeling that they're not a man and their masculinity has been challenged so many times throughout their lives that get them into this depression-like state?
Are you talking to like mass shootings? Or are you talking about like a lot of men that struggle in general?
I think both.
Yeah. So, you know, it's the research has this really, in men's mental health, has this really like interesting, some will say like kind of double jeopardy, in that men who experience or men who conform to more of those traditional masculine norms are more likely actually to develop mental health issues, but are less likely to seek help for them. So it's just this really unfortunate situation that the men who are most vulnerable in many of these cases are at least more likely to develop, whether it is not just mood problems, but lots of substance use problems and things like that, are also less likely then to seek help because they value handling problems on their own, just taking care of things themselves. You know, they end up throwing themselves into their work or into, now it's these days like, you know, Tinder hookups and things like that, obviously substance use and things. And so they mask or hide from a lot of the emotional distress. And then what gets attention is these acting out behaviors, you know, like, oh, you're drinking a lot. Oh, you know, you're working all the time. That's all you do is work. And so that, obviously doing all sorts of casual sexual playboy types, you know, relationships. And those things really draw attention because they can be really destructive. But they also ignore that in many of those cases, there's other kinds of emotional distress underneath that, whether it is histories of trauma, histories of abuse, or, you know, untreated mood and anxiety disorders. Mm-hmm. Lots of times, social anxiety, generalized anxiety that I'll see men cover up through some of these other kinds of behaviors, especially substance use. You'll see that, mm-hmm. especially for like social anxiety.
Well, do you think it has a lot to do with like values in our society, what men should really value, as well as kind of what the media says a man should be, movies, television shows?
Exactly. Like those, the pressure to conform to those masculine norms, you know, if you think about it too, it's there's a lot of pressure for guys to, you know, be on top and be in charge, whether, and being on top, being in charge means being dominant, not showing weakness. Yep. It often means not having a lot of close relationships and being vulnerable. It means sometimes not having or prioritizing friendships or family, because people are, men, a lot of men are, have that pressure to be on the top, be in control, be yep. successful. And that leaves them very lonely. And they're often the things that actually give people the most meaning in life are often the opposite of being mm-hmm. on the top. It is those relationships, those moments of vulnerability, those connections, the family relationships, yeah. things like that, that many men actually end up finding a lot of meaning in. But for a long time, they find they've had all this pressure and they've worked towards this masculine ideal. And then I might be seeing them later in life and they're like, yeah, you know, I've accomplished these things, but I'm not happy.
Right.
And their wives aren't happy. You know, their kids aren't happy. Like, it's unfortunate. It creates this sort of systemic effect on a lot of lives.
Well, yeah, it's almost like a profile where you want to look good. You want to get all these certifications, these master's degrees, PhDs. You think people are going to look at you differently and you think you're going to feel differently having all these nice accomplishments, nice cars, nice house.
Yeah.
And it might give you like a short-term high, but at the end of the day, from what I've noticed is that it is. That's all it is a short-term high. And then you go back to normal and you're like, what now?
Exactly. Exactly. Like, you know, when I've worked with some men and I will, you know, be working with them around their mood or anxiety, and I'll talk about antidepressant activities and mm-hmm. how, you know, it's really important that on a regular basis that, you know, people engage in activities that give them, you know, enjoyment or pleasure and give them accomplishment and give them meaning in their life. But what I find is a lot of men focus purely on the accomplishment. And so, yes, they get some lift yeah. to their mood. They do feel better. Like, it does feel good to accomplish mm-hmm. things. But if something happens, like in their career or, mm-hmm. You know, financially, it leaves them so vulnerable to depression, substance use, things like that. Their life crumbles because they put all their eggs in one basket of sorts. They've yeah. really focused on accomplishment. And they don't have much in the way of enjoyment in their life. And they don't have as much in the way of meaning in their life. And so, you know, they are, they feel just really in those cases kind of like empty. And it can be a downward spiral after that.
You know, honestly, the first thought that's really popping in my head after all that is just, again, how we handle issues in the workplace or failure. And I feel like a lot of times we're programmed to handle things in a assertive but very aggressive manner to, again, like you said, show that dominance, where if you, let's say, hypothetically have a disagreement with someone, well, you can't show weakness, because if you show weakness, you're a coward and people are going to walk over you. I mean, it's programmed in our heads on how to handle mm-hmm. situations.
It totally comes, you're right. Like it becomes the culture of organizations, because men are in charge of many organizations. They've set the culture. Many organizations are very patriarchal, as well as our, you know, Western culture is as well. So you're right, it gets institutionalized. And so what's valued in many organizations is like being right, not flip-flopping, you know, winning and
yes.
Sometimes at all costs, even
yes.
Not seeking help sometimes, and putting work honestly first. And they may not be the explicit message, but implicitly is sent. And then that is just, you know, put into the, it's indirectly put into the policies and the procedures and, you know, whether guys have, you know, time off for paternity leave and things like that, yep. like all those things are a remnant of, you know, the patriarchy in these organizations, all the male dominance and things.
Mm-hmm. You know, that also kind of reminds me of, as it comes to success, is little kids playing sports and their parents.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I will like watch it and they will treat their child like they're going to be in the pros. And they're constantly on them. And it's like, you need to win, 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 win. And the therapy side of me is like, planning in my head, like a family chart, and it's like, okay, you're showing triangulation like behavior now, because again, they live their lives to these kids, mm-hmm. and yeah. the child might be thinking like, I need to win or else my parents won't like me or love me, and that's the only way I can get affection for people, if I'm successful, if I win, if I accomplish things.
Absolutely. And I've worked with, you know, young adults and men who are really living from the effects of that,
yeah.
where there was just, you know, immense pressure to perform in sports. And if they didn't perform, like, they felt like their, sometimes their, particularly like their father's love would be yep. withdrawn from them. And you know, so, yeah. Exactly. You know, sometimes it was very explicit, like literally yelling at them. And they had really poignant moments in their adolescence where their value was largely determined based off their performance in sports. And so then that has, you know, manifested later on in life with like their performance at work, the amount mm-hmm. of money that they achieve, those kinds of things, that pursuit of status. Now the status has expanded beyond sports and these other areas, and they find themselves like pursuing these things with all their you know, focus, energy, and they find that they're still not happy, and that this is really stemming from these earlier adolescent and childhood experiences, and status wasn't everything, and it didn't give them happiness fully. And mm-hmm. So helping them to redefine what really, what are their values in life has been a lot of the work with those individuals, is helping them to reconnect with their values or identify their values, which takes some time because they've heard again and again and again, success, 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 you know, dominance, power, work, all those kinds of things. So their initial responses when you try to do some, you know, values clarification work with them is really just some, you know, modification of those values. So it really mm-hmm. does take some deeper work and some time for them to move beyond that, rather than just replicate those same things again now in their adulthood.
So would that be your male goal as a therapist working with a male with these issues, is just really help them understand where these problems are coming from and redefining their values and what's important to them in their lives, not what's important in our society, but what is important mm-hmm. to you, and don't get affected by society's beliefs on what a man should be.
I 100% agree. That is a really good summary of what I strive to do with men, mm-hmm. because I remember way back in grad school being, you know, told by my advisor, like, don't talk about masculinity in therapy. Don't talk about like manhood and stuff like that, because it's really easy to intellectualize. And many of those, like those conversations go really big picture very quickly in most of those cases. I've found that guys avoid actually talking about themselves and their emotional experience. And they'll talk about, you know, masculinity or what guys do in general and stuff. So what, instead of, I have focused much more using things like acceptance and commitment therapy to help men to, diffuse from some of their mm-hmm. limiting thoughts that really yeah. restrict maybe how they view themselves and what they want from their lives. Mm-hmm. And so help them to get a little bit distance from those really limiting thoughts, which, because I think those thoughts are ultimately influenced by cultural norms around masculinity, but yeah. it brings it back down to their level. So what are some of those unhelpful thoughts that just keep pushing you in this direction that isn't making you happy? Yeah. How do we get some space from them? And then how do we find out what really does matter to you in life? And some of that involves some experimentation, because they will be reluctant to focus more on their friendships or on other kinds of relationships with potential partners. And they will be pretty ambivalent. And so I'll really try to work with them to be like, okay, your mind's telling you these things that, yeah, you know, work is what matters. You got to put in your hours. Mm-hmm. If you want to be that, you know, great computer programmer or go out to Silicon Valley and make all this money, like, yeah, you got to put mm-hmm. in those hours, type of thing. But let's actually see, like, if you do spend some time, you know, going to yoga classes or trying to expand some of those, you know, friendships beyond just your time at the gym, what is it actually like? How do you actually feel when you do this, you know, repeatedly? Mm-hmm. And many of them do fine. Like, yeah, when I, you know, my mind is telling me to pursue all this other stuff, but when I really put myself out there and continually do these other things, I do start to benefit from it. So it's getting them connected to those experiences, I think, is just really important, because their mind will, again, will limit them more and more and more. So,
yeah. Well, another avenue that's coming to mind is, again, going back to like movies. And again, I think there's some strategy to this. I'm not sure how they try to program kids. Mm-hmm. And they'll show like pictures of like, let's say, the Predator with Arnold Schwarzenegger, big muscles, and he's really popular, or like a tall, muscular guy with a hot chick. And for you to get the hot chick, you got to be this, this, and this to be happy and with her. And I think it's a powerful thing how, again, it gets programmed in our, to our kids.
Yeah. They've done research, you know, looking at, you know, the toys that many boys are given, right? And they're just completely unrealistic. Yeah, especially the army ones, similar to like Barbie's proportions, right? Like are not healthy. Similarly, it's equally unhealthy. Yeah. A lot of the characters in boys' toys, primarily with, you know, muscular statures, it's just like pretty much impossible. Making a guy feel a little bit, you know, less than, or can have a really a powerful effect on them. And any kind of threat to their masculinity, they'll often want to reassert themselves. So they then identify more and more with some of those, with some of those movies and TV shows that are hyper-masculine, or we might use the word like very, very heavily, like restrictive masculinity. Mm-hmm. Because those same types of shows and media threaten men's masculinity or threaten the sense of manhood. Yeah. And so they tend to reassert themselves to try to demonstrate that they are masculine by probably really attaching to some of those sports teams or some of those violent, you know, strong movie characters, those kinds of things.
You know, when you brought up the doll, there was this one documentary where this doctor was showing a bunch of these army dolls, like men army dolls. And he's like, look at the size of these dolls from like the 50s and 60s. He was like this regular looking average Joe guy with a military suit on, and he was fine. But then the 70s, he kept getting a little bit bigger and muscular. Then the 80s and 90s, he started getting more ripped, shredded, bigger. And he just asked us all questions like, why is this? Why are these programs or these toy companies doing this as time goes on?
Exactly. I think we see it today too in other extreme forms of masculinity on social media. Even if it's just, you know, Instagram photos and things like that of unrealistic representations of men that just are not sustainable or not achievable by many men.
Well, and it's sad too, because a lot of times when they see these even videos or pictures, it's not real, because they can be edited by like Instagram pictures. I mean, there's a lot of things you can do to change the way these people look. So it's not real regardless of who it is.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's, you know, really, especially if people are selling any kind of health product, right? It totally fits into that. Yeah. You know, you challenge a man's sense of manhood, make him feel, make things, manhood is very precarious. Like you're constantly having to demonstrate it. And so give a hit to a guy's ego and then say, oh, we got this product for you that will solve that for you. And you'll be bigger, stronger, better. That, you know, whether it's the health industry, but also I think a lot of the movies and sports are just guys' ways of sort of connecting with this masculine ideal that is a fantasy, you know.
Yes. Now I want to get into the social media realm of things. And
yeah,
I'm sure we've all heard of the gentleman, Andrew Tate.
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. He's one of those individuals that has really drawn a lot of attention and criticism around masculinity and everything.
Yeah. I could be wrong, but I feel like he's been getting really big for the past 6 months. I don't know about you, because I didn't know who he was like a year ago, 2 years ago, but he's just really hitting the stage hard right now.
Absolutely. I think that there is I mean, the more extreme you are, right, the more attention you're going to get. So I think part of this is a show.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, if he was just presenting a less, a more balanced approach to masculinity, right, he would not be getting the retweets and stuff like that. So
yeah,
his kind of caricature of extreme masculinity, I'm sure is wonderful marketing for himself. But a lot of guys are not viewing it as that. They're viewing him as a role model.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So a lot of guys, you know, they are not achieving what these masculine ideals are in life. Yeah. In terms of like status and winning and in work. Yeah. And in relationships. And so he tries to answer that question for them by basically kind of, I think, blaming women, blaming society for not reinforcing traditional values of manhood. Yes. And it's just a really simple answer. Like, it's women and society not giving men what they deserve because they're trying to feminize men.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I really, if I can ever meet this guy, is like, I personally, as a single man, like, I agree with some of the stuff he says. Mm-hmm. He just comes off way too strong. That's that intensity we're just like talking about. And on a side note, I think it's ironic. He says he respects women, but he calls them bitches nonstop on his videos. But that's exactly a topic for a different day. But it's like, dude, like, you do actually say some good things, but take it down a notch. The way you're coming off is just way too intense, super aggressive. I think a lot more people would like him if he did chill out a little bit. I think he'd get more fans, but he, like you said, he may not be as popular as he is. But
yeah, I mean, his mission is not to improve the health of men.
Yeah.
And to improve society, right? I mean, there's a clear financial motives there. So he's looking to get retweets and likes and all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, his more, maybe more balanced views that you mentioned that you've seen kind of, yeah, behind all of the loudness and stuff. That's not what draws attention. It's like, yeah, these misogynistic comments, really adhering to these really archaic views about how, yeah, men have to be, that are really like caveman perceptions of it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately really limit men and take them, I think, it really get in the way of a lot of men, I think, from pursuing their values, which is what I keep coming back to. And I think, mm-hmm, unfortunately, his extreme forms of masculinity, like, though they get implanted in the guy's thoughts, like some manifestation of various men's thoughts. And it really limits them and gets them, mm-hmm, gets in the way of them, you know, being more vulnerable with their son and daughter, taking more time for leisure that may mean they aren't the CEO of the company. You know, when they approach dating and things like that, they may approach it in a way that is less domineering and everything. But that's hard when the messages they, mm-hmm, hear are so extreme.
Yeah.
And it really takes guys away from, I think, a lot of their actual values.
Yeah. Well, and from my mindset, like, I really feel like it is like the therapist side of me is trying to just catch the good and ignore the bad.
Yeah.
And I want to tell him, dude, stop. You're actually saying some good things, but you're tarnishing the good things you're actually saying with your masculinity and drama and so forth.
Absolutely. Like he's not inherently a bad person and is not inherently, like, I think, trying to cause harm for society, right? He's probably a very broken individual. Why else, yeah, would you act in such a dramatic way, in a way that, like, clearly there's a lot of fragility on there. Why would yes. you be so bombastic and loud unless you were really, really fragile and covering yeah. something up? So I agree. Like, there is probably a core to him that is very probably like broken and has issues, and he's not inherently bad. Unfortunately, just like a lot of men, like, you know, they get caught up in doing masculinity in ways that can be really toxic, whether it is, you know, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll type stuff that they end up mm-hmm. doing or whatever, that can take them really far away from their values.
Yeah. Some of the things that I've heard him and other people say in this avenue, because again, he's not the only one preaching this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. There's this new thing. It's not new, but it's like the blue pill, red pill. And I don't want to explain it wrong because I could be butchering it, but I think that the red pill is more about like men sticking up for themselves. But again, you could take it to the extreme. The things that I like him with others are preaching, the good things, is men sticking up for themselves with women. Mm-hmm. I like that. Increase your self-worth, which he does preach. And know when you're being taken advantage of by women, especially in the dating scene. Know certain signs and this and that. And again, not to be taken advantage of. And I think those are good things he is teaching to, let's say, the single men out there.
Well, and I wonder, you know, if we might also be, you know, there are a lot of individuals, men or women, who might be passive in relationships, right?
Like starting out.
Yeah, start out, they're pretty passive in relationships. They're focused on other people's needs and not getting their own needs met. And I definitely work with a lot of guys who do find themselves in that role. And my work with them is not around how to be a better playboy or be more mm-hmm. domineering or how to kind of like make women submissive to them. That's not what I do. Instead, I work with them to figure out like what really are, you know, your needs, and how do we work on more effectively communicating your needs to your partner. Yes. And we'll see if they meet those needs or not. They may not meet those needs, and that's really important information. That's, you know, if it's, you know, depending on the orientation of the sexual orientation of the individual, that, you know, male or female may not be a good match for you.
Yeah.
And let's go find someone else who is. You don't have to change yourself for them. So I think there's a way to get at what he's identified as a problem that doesn't lead to, I think, misogyny and sexism, dominance over women, playboy type behaviors. Because I like there are other ways that I think both people can benefit, women and men can benefit from, when it really involves men more clearly communicating what their needs are.
One thing I want to add, like we talked about earlier, maybe he kind of preys on certain men who have been taken advantage of by women, going back to that,
yeah,
and who've wasted money, time, have been insulted by women. So I can imagine, yes, all those men flocking to him as their leader.
Bingo, right? Like that, you know, highlight a weakness or vulnerability that some men have, make it a big deal and say, okay, you know, that weakness or vulnerability is a huge deal. That defines you as a man. And then I have a solution for you. And, you know, watch my videos, like and retweet and subscribe. And it's a very simple answer. It's one that reinforces probably some beliefs that some men have and that some of our culture have said. And it doesn't really lead to men having to, often in those cases, like change themselves in some way. It's like, well, society and other people, and especially women, need to be deferential to me. They need to let me be my rightful place in society on top, because that's where guys should be. So if they just put me back in my place where I was supposed to be, then I'd be happier and everybody would be better. So that's the answer I feel like he's trying to give.
Well, the male is the king of the house, you know, the head. And there's another thing that was he just thinks it's like strongly like wrong for a woman to cheat on a man, but it's more appropriate for a man to cheat on a woman. And he'll argue his viewpoints on that. And sadly, I think society agrees with him, or just like society says, it's okay for men to sleep with millions and millions of women, but if a woman does it, she's a slut.
Exactly. Like he's, and I think he's playing on the vulnerabilities that you mentioned, that because there are a lot of men who are not successful relationship wise. Mm-hmm. And so rather than looking at, you know, bigger issues with, you know, how, it's harder for many men to get well-paying jobs that have good benefits and long-term careers and all those other kinds of things where they feel that status and stuff like that. You know, and those things obviously help to obtain partners and maintain them and stuff. And but no, let's give a simple answer that doesn't really deal with larger systemic issues that are complicated, that involve, you know, the way the labor force has changed and, you know, automation and all those other kinds of forces that might be affecting a lot of men's careers and works and those kinds of things.
No, and another viewpoint, another person talked about, not Andrew Tate, but to flip it, these women would call in about issues like this too. Again, they're very angry. It's double standards, right? That's just our culture and our society is double standards when it comes to men and women.
For sure.
The scary thing is there's actually been some research where women will agree that, yeah, women should not have a lot of sexual partners, and it is okay for men to have sexual partners, multiple. So that's kind of like the scary thing where it's like society feels one way, and now research is showing women also feel that way towards each other, and they're more accepting of men cheating in their behaviors.
Yeah, and that's, I think, what we would, right, we would actually kind of expect with how we socialize women, you know, to be deferential and to accept those kinds of behaviors, and to normalize those kinds of behaviors. Even though it's you know, harmful to them, because like women who do want to have, you know, many relationships and sexual partners, you know, should be able to do that if it's what they want. But you know, when many women have internalized those messages that they know that that's shameful and horrible, will also internalize the messages that that's just how guys are. Boys will be boys.
Yes,
you know, that kind of thing.
And another guy said something too, which is really interesting. This mindset actually goes back to like 16, 1700s, where when men obviously had a lot of power, as they do now, but the man wants to know the child is his.
Yeah, they really like to, sorry, I interrupted you. Do you want to go on?
Oh, no, but that's just so powerful. It's just like, you know, if a woman cheats and fools around, it increases the chances of, I don't know if that's my child, and I'm not going to be stuck raising a child that's not mine. You're dead to me. Like,
yeah, like I'm going to like actually say that, like, that is a distraction. So a lot of these, sort of social media type folks or whatever that say these sensational things love to create stories about things that may or may not have happened hundreds of years ago, about cavemen, about this or that, to justify, you know, sexist, misogynistic, patriarchal type, you know, behaviors and cultures. And so it is a really common thing that I see is trying to go back to how things, you know, truly were, how men really are, or their essential selves, and then use that to explain away behaviors that simply are not, you know, healthy or productive or helpful to current society.
Well, like you said, it's very far in between, because a lot of times too, have you ever heard of the term, obviously this one's more popular, alpha and beta? The beta man and the alpha man. Now that's starting to get really popular, where they're saying like a high value man is alpha. So when we think of high value man, what do we think of? Is it just, do they make a lot of money? Are they strong, confident, successful? Is that what a man should be? And a beta is just a lesser man with that, with less confidence.
Yeah, exactly. And there's those are all like really, when you break them down, get very complex, but they're continuing to grasp for historical times when men's power was not challenged, and trying to justify getting back to that. And so those things are really premised on when you dig down a bit, men's dominance over women, you know, and patriarchy. And so they're grasping for those times. And I get it. Like, a lot of men are struggling. A lot of men don't feel the benefits of modern society. They don't feel like, they don't feel a lot of, even though they may have privilege, they don't experience it as privilege. And so they're grasping for these days in the past, this sort of fantasy. But not only, you know, were those days horribly harmful to women, you know, racial, ethnic minorities, LGBTQ individuals, but also they were really bad for men, like being on top and being, yeah. you know, in the dominant group comes at great cost, because you still, like, you look at, you know, Mad Men back in the 60s, you know, that TV episode, all of them were drunk.
Yeah.
They were womanizing. They were not happy either. Being on top like that, it leads to a lot of unhappiness, but it's covered up by a lot of very bad behaviors.
I ask your opinion on something. Do you also feel like the feminine movement now, or the Me Too movement now, is also causing some issues?
In what way?
I guess I'll use a couple of examples that I saw online, but and I could be wrong, but it's more portraying the issues women are having now, but they're ignoring issues that men have too. And a lot of it is relationship based too. So yes, have women been mistreated by men back in the 50s, 60s, 70s? Beaten? Absolutely. It is horrendous. And those men should be, you know, held accountable for their actions. Mm-hmm. But now you really don't hear a lot about women beating men.
Mm-hmm.
Or
women
harming men, or it's not brought to the light of the news.
Yeah.
Or men just don't talk about it.
Exactly. So that is, I think, the key to it, because yes, and like things like intimate partner violence, yes, like a lot of men are experiencing intimate partner violence, you know, from, you know, women and from other men. But it's not necessarily, I would argue that it's actually like the sort of restrictive views of masculinity and manhood in our culture that lead men to be quiet and not want to like lose face and be dominant in those situations, versus actually, you know, being kind of open and vulnerable, reporting those things as well. So I don't blame women. I think it's probably the consequences of a lot of guys trying to keep their status on the top and not wanting to look, you know, weak, like, oh, you know, my wife did hit me too. Because that might make them look weak or to lose status as well. So I don't blame women. And of course, nobody should be hitting anybody. That's
right.
That's different. But the silence that a lot of men bring to it, or why we don't talk about it, I think has to do with, masculinity more than femininity.
Mm-hmm. And like we always say, like, things taken to the extreme can always cause issues too.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Well, Matt, I just had an amazing time with you, man. I felt like we got into so many great things. And I had
cover a lot. I really enjoyed it as well. My gosh, we covered the whole spectrum. So I really appreciate you bringing this topic out to your audience, because I think a lot of men suffer in silence. I mean, men, again, die 4 times more likely than women. So this is really important that we think about men's mental health. Because they, you know, make up around half the population, and we don't want to ignore what might be going on there on the inside.
Oh, all very important, man. So just for you, this is a question I normally like to ask, is like, what are your future goals in the next 5 to 10 years? Do you want to open another facility, write a book? What could those projects look like?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I myself had a life-changing event where, you know, I lost my job about a year ago, and really caused me to reevaluate what I'm doing career-wise. And now with having a soon-to-be 4-year-old, I'm finding that...
Congrats.
That just right now probably isn't going to be the time that I'm going to be on top of the career is not going to be my top priority. So I'm really want things that allow for flexibility so that I can be around for my son and stuff. So, and my family. So I'm really enjoying, individual therapy, working with a lot of men and some women as well. I'm doing some coaching as well. I may broaden into my areas more executive coaching so I can blend my MBA and my clinical psychology together more. So I might go down some of that path, but we'll see. I mean, I did love being in hospital leadership and helping to make bigger changes in organizations and expand mental health access in big organizations. So we'll see if I go back to that or not, but I've been really, really enjoying kind of coming back to doing one-on-one clinical work and coaching now.
Absolutely. No, that's all great stuff, man. And I wish you nothing but the best. Now, if any of my listeners do want to get a hold of you, is there a particular website or email they could use?
Yeah, I would love for you to go to MatthewSizdek.com. If you could put that in the show notes. And I provide individual psychotherapy. I provide coaching. And I provide consultation. So I enjoy doing all that work and appreciate you letting folks know about it.
Excellent. And to all my listeners, I will put those links on my show notes. So Matt will be one click away for you.
Thank you.
I again want to thank Matthew for being an awesome and amazing guest on the BHI show. I also want to thank all of my listeners for supporting me. It truly means a lot. And I just want to inform everyone that the information expressed on this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a licensed medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. I also want to inform everyone, if you do want to make contact with me, my email is behavioralhealthintegration121@gmail.com. I also have a LinkedIn account and my website is behavioralhealthintegration.org. I'll make sure I put that in the show notes. And again, stay tuned for next week when I interview two professionals regarding ketamine-assisted therapy, which would be Sam and Steven Mendel from California. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called Comigo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to, again, help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed. And until next time, thank you, everyone, and have a good day. Bye.